Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 292, The Inconceivable Liberation and the Womb of Compassion.
Living ordinary life in a way where one thinks one is not doing anything about it is maybe possible, but it shouldn't be possible, in the sense that under this kind of concept, idea, the normal flow of thought, the normal flow of experience, the television commercial, the sign on the road as one drives by and so forth, all of these things are a kind of a process of meditation. Therefore, in some sense, it is impossible not to be either transforming in some direction or another. Once there's no sort of anchor of sort of an absolute identity core that holds everything into an exact pattern, as a presumed within soul theories, what you'd call fixed or absolute soul theories. Once there is no such thing, then the being is totally fluctuating. One's uniqueness is a totally fluctuating process. In that sense, if it's not getting better, it's getting worse. There's no staying the same. There, you know, reading the newspaper is meditating. Talking with one's neighbors is meditating. Meditation becomes a completely constant activity. Dreaming is meditating. Deep sleep is meditating. It is not a question of shall I choose to meditate or not. It is what shall I meditate on? What shall I put in as the content of my meditation? Among meditations, again, remember, one-pointed meditation, meditation of withdrawing from external stimuli and thoughts and so forth, is only one kind. The other kind is ruminative meditation, thematic meditation, meditation that is cultivating, inculcating certain sensibility or state of mind or emotional orientation or whatever it may be, but it is what's called discursive or analytic meditation that is a type of meditation. So in this context, again, this coming back to this issue of yoga of ordinary life, it is not a question of shall we practice the Dharma or shall we do this meditating? It's simply a question of shall I meditate on 20th century American culture by thinking I'm doing nothing special. So anyway, this is something that we're going, and in this context, now we come to the inconceivable liberation issue, which deals with this in the most direct way, given the background of anything being possible of emptiness. And here we come to what April is asking about the Dharma. Poor Shariputra has a thought. In the Inconceivable Liberation chapter, he has a very good thought. They're in this room. There's 100,000 people in the room, which we never mind about that. It's just a typical Zen master's 10-foot square room, but there's 100,000 people and gods and so forth in the room somehow managing. And only Vimalakirti is sitting down in this room. He's actually lying on a kind of like a chaise-long type of thing.
Is he still sick?
Oh, yeah, he's supposed to be sick, yes. Yes, sick, except for his big mouth. Only his mouth is not sick. And he's lying there, he's old too. And nobody else has a place to sit. So Shariputra obviously realizes the unseemliness of this, since they're obviously in there for the duration type of thing, this group. And among these people, there are very great bodhisattvas, and there are great gods, and there are great elders of the city, and there are great saints of the order, monks, you know, like, you know, bishops and things like this. And where are they going to sit? He thinks to himself. He's sort of looking for the folding chairs, you know, or the cushions or the pillows. In India, sitting on the floor, as you know, is not really considered. You know? Then the lachavi, even without some kind of cushion. Then Vimalakirti read the thought of the Venerable Shariputra. And he said, Reverend Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of the Dharma? Or did you come here for the sake of a chair? Oh, I came for the Dharma, he says, not for a chair. No. Vimalakirti continued, Reverend Shariputra, he who is interested in the Dharma is not interested even in his own body, much less in a chair. He who is interested in the Dharma has no interest in matter, sensation, intellect, motivation, or consciousness, the five aggregates. He has no interest in these aggregates, or in the elements, or in the sense media. Interested in the Dharma, he has no interest in the realm of desire, the realm of matter, or the immaterial realm. Interested in the Dharma, he is not interested in attachment to the Buddha, attachment to the Dharma, or attachment to the Sangha. He who is interested in the Dharma is not interested in recognizing suffering, abandoning its origination, realizing its cessation, or practicing the path. The four truths are just knocked out there. If you're interested in the Dharma, you're not interested in that. Why? The Dharma is ultimately without formulation and without verbalization. Who verbalizes, quote, suffering should be recognized, origination should be eliminated, cessation should be realized, the path should be practiced, which is what the Buddha said in his first sutra, of course, but who does verbalize that? Is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in verbalization. Reverend Shariputra, the Dharma is calm and peaceful. Those who are engaged in production and destruction are not interested in the Dharma, are not interested in solitude, but are interested in production and destruction. Furthermore, Shariputra, the Dharma is without taint and free of defilement. He who is attached to anything, even to liberation, is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in the taint of desire. The Dharma is not an object. He who pursues objects is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in objects. The Dharma is without acceptance or rejection. He who holds on to things or lets go of things is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in holding and letting go. The Dharma is not a secure refuge. He who enjoys a secure refuge is not interested in the Dharma, but is interested in a secure refuge. These things, each thing he's saying, are totally heretical things to say, by the way. I mean, the Dharma refuge, the Dharma jewel is the refuge. It is the supreme of all the refuges and so forth, although actually it is nirvana that is the refuge in a way. The Dharma is without sign. He whose consciousness pursues signs is not interested in the Dharma but interested in signs. The Dharma is not a society. He who seeks to associate with the Dharma is not interested in the Dharma but interested in association. The Dharma is not a sight, a sound, a category, or an idea. He who is involved in sights, sounds, categories, and ideas, etc., is interested in them, not the Dharma. It goes on, free of compounded and uncompounded. Thereupon, he said, Reverend Shariputra, if you are interested in the Dharma, you should take no interest in anything. Shariputra, you know, all I wanted was the people to sit down. You know? When Vimalakirti had spoken this discourse, 500 gods obtained the purity of the Dharma eye in viewing all things. Then, of course, Vimalakirti then does what Shariputra wanted, after having first given him a hard time. He then says, Manjushri, you have been in innumerable hundreds of thousands of Buddha fields throughout the universes of the 10 directions. In which Buddha field did you see the best lion thrones with the finest qualities? In other words, not just chairs, but Buddha thrones, lion thrones. The lion thrones are like Ashoka's lion throne, the Buddha's lion throne. They're royal thrones. But in this case, they're Buddha royal thrones, which are more than royal thrones. There's incredible things. Like if you ever see a full description, like in the Pure Land Sutra, of the lion throne of the Buddha, it's in a marvelous chair, really. Manjushri says that in a universe called Merudvaja, and it's very interesting, that universe, Merudvaja. Merudvaja means the banner of the axial mountain, of the polar mountain. Now, in the old cosmology, as you know, there was not a round planet, but there was this giant polar mountain at the center of the universe, sort of like the axis mundi, you know, like the spinal column of the universe. And this was this giant, like 70 million miles tall mountain. So a universe that was called Merudvaja, banner of the polar mountain, is a universe of tremendous axiality, I mean by the name. The Buddha of that universe, his name is Meru Pradipa Raja, the king of the lamp of the axial mountain. And the Buddha thrones, the lion thrones there, are 3,400 leagues tall of the bodhisattvas. And the lion thrones of that Buddha, whose height is 8,400,000 leagues, the height of that Buddha, his chair, his throne, is 6,800,000 leagues tall. And that's the best throne in the universe that Manjushri ever saw. Naturally, it's 6,800,000 leagues tall, 7 miles is a league, as you know. You can add it up. It's bigger than, it's quite a big chair. So then Vimalakirti, so those are the finest and most superb thrones, says Manjushri. So then Vimalakirti then focused himself in concentration, performed a miraculous feat such that the Lord Tathagata Meru Pradipa Raja in the universe Merudvaja sent to this universe 3,200,000 thrones. You know, like ordered up, delivered in a truck. 3,200,000 of these giant thrones. These thrones were so tall, spacious, and beautiful
that the Bodhisattvas, great disciples, Shakras, Brahmas, Lokapalas, and other gods had never seen the like. The thrones descended from the sky and came to rest in the house of Vimalakirti. 3,200,000 thrones, which are 3,200,000 leagues tall each. They arranged themselves without crowding, and the house seemed to enlarge itself accordingly. The great city of Vaishali did not become obscured, neither did the land of Jambudvipa, nor the world of the four continents. Everything appeared just as it was before, except there was hundreds of thousands of thousand-mile-tall, many thousand-mile-tall thrones in the house. It's a trip. It's a real trip. Yeah, he's obviously, it was the beginning of a trip. He's setting up the setting of a trip, obviously. Then Lichama Vimalakirti said to the young prince Manjushri, "Now, Manjushri, let the bodhisattvas be seated on these thrones, having transformed their bodies to a suitable size." Then those bodhisattvas who had attained the super knowledges transformed their bodies to the proper height of 4,200,000 leagues and sat upon the thrones. But the beginner bodhisattvas were not able to do that. So then he taught these beginner bodhisattvas a teaching that enabled them to attain the five super knowledges, and having one of which is the telekinetic knowledge of being able to transform oneself dimensionally. And having attained them, they transformed their bodies to that height and sat upon the thrones. But still the great disciples were unable to sit upon the thrones. That is, Shariputra and Kashyapa are now feeling like micronauts. You know, they're feeling like microscopic specks. These giant things in this place, and they're feeling completely lost, like tiny little like dust specks. And they can't sit on the thrones, they can't learn the teaching that he's teaching, they're totally lost. So they say, of course, they complain. They say, then Vimalakirti says to Shariputra, "Reverend Shariputra, take your seat upon a throne." Notice this one, this is very interesting, that then Shariputra replies, "Good sir, the thrones are too big and too high, I cannot sit upon them." Vimalakirti said, "Reverend Shariputra, bow down to the Tathagata Meru Pradipa Raja, and you will be able to take your seat." That is the Tathagata of that other universe who sent over the chairs, who is like 90 million miles tall. They're seeing him temporarily over there, like through this dimensional portal, and who sent the chairs through this portal, you know, and he's there. And they say, "Bow to that Tathagata, to the disciples, and then you can sit." And they did it, and they can. And then everybody's seated on the chair. That's kind of interesting in the sense that in regard to this teaching, there's sort of three approaches. There's either one who is already at the point where they can automatically swing with the teaching, you know, an advanced bodhisattva. There's one who is really just really needs to sort of think and hear about it and they understand it. Not too difficult for them. And they attain urdhi, you know, this telekinetic, transdimensional ability, imaginative kind of ability. And then there are those who cannot do it any other way but temporarily only through faith. We begin to get the dimension of bhakti, of faith. Through faith in that Tathagata, they can, at least temporarily, through the grace of that Tathagata, by being receptive to which they can, are, through faith, they can also enter into this dimension. Now, what is this dimension that they are entering? Why does Vimalakirti seat everyone on a throne? What does it mean to seat people on a throne? Not only on an ordinary throne, but on a Buddha throne. Why before teaching this teaching of inconceivable liberation, should everybody sit on a Buddha throne? Everybody has to be a Buddha, you know, of course. And what does it mean to be a Buddha? What does it mean? Buddhas have no self either. Buddha does not have a vacuum-plated, you know, platinum dog tag saying one Buddha, you know, so on. Either. Buddha is also a unique, particular kind of nexus kind of thing. But he is that kind of unique nexus that is sort of the evolutionary goal of beings, in that it's a being who's totally self-satisfied and totally effective at satisfying others. So an ideal being in that sense, you know, an incarnation of love. Now why should people have to be Buddhas in a sense, or anticipatorily be Buddhas, or explore the aesthetic of being a Buddha? What is the aesthetic of being a Buddha? If you were a Buddha, how might it feel? That means if you were someone who was completely self-satisfied, in a good sense, you know, contented, totally, ecstatic maybe, you know, Buddha with a grin on your face, certain kind of grin that a Buddha has, you know. And yet, not just sort of smug, because not disconnected from other beings, but also secure also in the knowledge of being, communicating that kind of happiness, sharing that happiness at optimal efficiency. Optimal efficiency being sort of only limited, and the happiness not being in a sense already total for everyone because of the limited receptivity of beings to that happiness. Themselves not only allowing themselves so much to happiness, at that time, although you, Buddha, maybe, if you were Buddha, you also see their future. You see that they are, once they are connected to a certain causality of a Buddha process, there's a certain process they're going to struggle through, and then they're going to be happy, and that future moment is in a way as real as the present moment that they presently are indulging in, concretizing and reifying and being sure that that's where they are and that they're really not happy, is no more real than when they will be Buddha and they will be happy. Which is why maybe Buddha can see the Buddhahood in the people, even though they can't maybe right away. But if they sit on a Buddha throne, in this particular type of context, maybe they can feel something of that Buddha feeling, which is a kind of, I mean, if you had finally gotten to be Buddha, would you or would you not be a little proud of yourself? Maybe. Oh, gee, I died a million trillion times. I gave away my eyes and ears and nose and tongue and body and wife and children and country and kingdom and wealth and etc. and soul billions of times. I struggled through all that. Phew, you know, they gobbled me down, the living beings did, life after life for billions of years. Now I don't need, the Dharma is automatically feeding them. My existence has become a great wheel, a great field that automatically satisfies all of these people. They themselves reach their own fruition and so forth. It's all like a white lotus flower type of thing. You might feel slightly self-confident, maybe a little bit peaceful, content, happy, in fact proud. Mm-hmm. Buddha has a certain pride and dignity. It is not pride as a poison, as an affliction, which is an unjustified pride. It is actually a justified pride. It's only a relative pride in the sense, it's an aesthetic sense. But it is what constitutes the dignity, majesty, glory, pride of a Buddha, is a certain kind of confidence, let's call it. Pride sounds a little frightening, although Buddha pride is something that one meditates in the Tantra system. The pride, the Buddha pride. But it is a kind of confidence. Now, it is a fact, isn't it, that certain things that you think are inconceivable, like walking on a tightrope, or like doing a certain asana, or doing some kind of something, you know, painting or a poem or whatever it may be, one of the major obstacles to being able to do it is have no confidence that you can do it. We all know that. You know, the child trying to ride the bicycle, they're sure they can't ride it, they keep tumbling off. But yet, once you're confident, you don't think twice the bicycle is solid as it could be. So confidence is a very important thing. Now, when you're especially talking about the imagination, when you're talking about a type of insight that involves a mobilization of your creative power, that is, not only a motivation of your critical powers, your rational powers, taking apart the universe like in our shunyata thing that we were doing yesterday, emptiness, seeing through the false appearances of things. But now, in addition to that which you keep in place, you don't throw that away, you add a creative aspect. You add a transformative aspect, a positive imaginative aspect as well. That might go better if you were self-confident, wouldn't it? And maybe you can't even understand that kind of thing. You can't even deal with that issue of reimagining the universe, of building a world, a Buddha land, unless you have confidence. The essential thing to it is having a kind of confidence. Therefore, essential to this teaching is the kind of ritual, actually, magical consecration or anointment ceremony that takes place at the beginning of this chapter, which is that everyone is enthroned on the Buddha plane. Everyone is enthroned in that great... Imagine if you felt yourself... Look how this is suggested here. Suddenly everybody's 4,200,000 miles tall. Imagine if you were meditating away there and you suddenly were 4,200,000 miles tall. Now Shariputra says, okay, it is astonishing that these thousands... Gee, Vimalakirti, wow, well, it's astonishing that these thousands of thrones... He's sitting up there. Now he's thousands of miles tall, Shariputra. He's kind of grooving on him. Gee, they're so big, so high, that they should fit in such a small house, and that the great city of Vaishali, the villages, cities, kingdoms, capitals of Jambudvipa, the other three continents, the abodes of the gods, the Nagas, the Yakshas, the Gandharvas, the Asuras, all these different mythical beings, that all of these should appear without any obstacle, just as they were before. He's sort of sitting up there on top of his giant Chase Manhattan chair, with his Chase Manhattan body, looking all over the universe, he's saying, wow, I mean, look at you, this is nice, you know, it's like, whee, you know, Shariputra is. So then he says, Reverend Shariputra, Vimalakirti does, for the Tathagata and the Bodhisattvas and the Bodhisattvas, there is a liberation called inconceivable. The Bodhisattva who lives in inconceivable liberation can put the king of mountains, Sumeru, that is the polar mountain. So I think in modern times, that sort of whole earth catalog picture of the planet, you know, the satellite picture of the planet is good to use in this meditation. Since we don't have the King of Mountains, it doesn't mean anything to us. Which is so high, so great, so noble, and so vast, the whole planet, you know, into a mustard seed. He can perform this feat without enlarging the mustard seed and without shrinking Mount Sumeru, or the planet. And the deities of the assembly of the four Maharajas and of the triest of the 33 heavens do not even know where they are. That is, the various beings on the planet don't know that that planet has now fitted inside a mustard seed. And even the deities who are floating over the polar cap don't know. Only those beings who are destined to be disciplined by miracles see and understand the putting of the King of Mountains, Sumeru, into the mustard seed. That, Reverend Shariputra, is an entrance into the domain of the inconceivable liberation of the Bodhisattvas. Now this is, again, this is a special kind of yoga of ordinary life, I'm saying. The mustard seed is ordinary reality, in some sense. The planet is a kind of cosmic level of dealing with that reality, a level of where goodness and love is not just sort of one out of two things, good and evil and so forth, but it is all powerful. It is the power of the universe, the strong force of the atom. It can do anything. It's a kind of reality. It's an extraordinary reality, a reality where this is a pure land, where this is a perfect land of medicine. It is a perfect vessel of teaching. It is established by a being who can see the future as equally real to the present and can therefore design an environment that is completely efficient, optimally efficient in sort of cooking, in maturing, in developing, in growing. You know, it's an agricultural metaphor in the notion of a Buddha field that can ripen the crop of the living beings in that field towards their own evolutionary perfection, towards Buddhahood, towards their own simultaneous selflessness and ability to fulfill the needs of all others and therefore establish further fields and further universes in that way. By having been able to see the full program, inconceivably, of course, omnisciently, all of the evolutionary patterns of the development of all of the beings, to create a land that is optimal service of those beings in bringing them towards, you know, if they need a little more suffering, if they need someone to save, if they need a whole country to feed, if they need a something to win, if they need a war to prevent, if they need a war to win, if they need a war to lose, whatever it is that they need that at that time, you know, and then they'll be reborn in this way, and then they'll be reborn in that way, and seeing all the succession of lives of all of those beings. I mean, this is theoretically a Buddha field, of course, what it is. Then that is the Sumeru, Mount Sumeru, that is the planetary, seeing the planet as just a tiny thing that can go into a mustard seed. So that is being able to see non-obstructively the extraordinary and the ordinary. Remember we talked earlier at the beginning, you have the Buddha's toe down, the extraordinary, where the Buddha changes the world into a pure land in the vision of the people temporarily to show them that their sense of it as a horrible place was part what had to do with their own imperfection of perception. And then he removed his toe and it looked like it did before. And then the question of this sort of two realities, in a way, two relative realities. There's another set of two realities of an absolute reality and a relative reality, where the absolute is emptiness and it isn't any particular way of being of the world at all. It's just the sort of ground nature, absoluteness of the world, its openness and relativity. But then within relative, there are the two relative realities of the extraordinary one and the ordinary one. In any case, for such a being, that is how the world is. Now, in the inconceivable liberation, Bodhisattva, or the person even by faith who is dealing with the inconceivable liberation on whichever level, ordinary life in that sense then contains, every mustard seed of ordinary life contains the planet, contains the whole. Each little piece contains everything. So that somehow all the future is contained in each instant. So that somehow one's every moment of one's ordinary life, in a sense, becomes a Buddha land building, a Buddha land enjoyment, a Buddha land sharing. It becomes an ultimate act every instant of one's life in this sense. This then becomes the yoga of ordinary life. Because the has to stay ordinary too. If you go around going, oh, have a cup of tea, you know, there's all Sumeru's mountains and everything in this Buddha land. Then the mustard seed has been stretched. You know, it's not the inconceivable liberation because the planet didn't go in the mustard seed without stretching the mustard seed. The mustard seed has been stretched. Suddenly everything has become sanctimonious. Everything has become ponderous. You know, one is a million miles tall. It's going to hardly get up in the morning. Have to rise up 4,200,000 miles. I'll never get up. And so on. It's so hopeless, you see. One has transferred the old naive realism to some miraculous reality and made that into a naive reality. So Shunyata is the ground of all of this, you see. Has to always emptiness, openness, that, you know, this extraordinary, so big deal, so it's a Buddha land, so it's what, you know? What else is new, kind of thing. I mean, that's ordinary and extraordinary interfuse, you see, in a certain way. I'm not sure what it means, although each time we bring together two impossibilities. See, this is another procedure. See, the emptiness procedure is a procedure of seeing the appearance and drilling through it with critical insight, analysis, tearing it apart, actually, in a way, analysis taking apart, you know. And finding its unfindability, or rather tolerating its unfindability, which is a much better way of putting it. Furthermore, Reverend Shariputra, the Bodhisattva who's, but look now, so each one of these metaphors then becomes important. The metaphor, the poem, the vision, the sort of creative tension of the imagination now becomes more important than the literal analytic kind of statement. The Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can pour into a single pore of his skin all the waters of the four great oceans without injuring the water animals such as fish, tortoises, crocodiles, frogs, and other creatures, and without the dragons, demons, fairies, titans, and so on, even being aware of where they are. And the whole operation is visible without any injury or disturbance to any of those living beings. Such a bodhisattva can pick up with his right hand this billion-world galactic universe, the Milky Way galaxy, as if it were a potter's wheel, and spinning it round, throw it beyond universes as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, without the living beings therein knowing their motion or its origin. And he can catch it and put it back in its place, without the living beings suspecting their coming and going. And yet the whole operation is visible. Just like take the Milky Way from within this planet and just spin it this direction, and it zooms around like a boomerang, you know, playing frisbee with the Milky Way. Right. Also, furthermore, Shariputra, there are beings who become disciplined after an immense period of evolution, and there are also those who are disciplined after a short period of evolution. The Bodhisattva who lives in inconceivable liberation for the sake of disciplining those beings who are disciplined through immeasurable periods of evolution can make the passing of a week seem like the passing of an aeon, and can make the passing of an aeon seem like the passing of a week for those who are disciplined through a short period of evolution, etc. In other words, time distortion can also take complete, you know, aeon means, you know, a whole cycle of world evolution, you know, like Carl Sagan's cosmic calendar in the movie, you know, like billions and billions of years can be only like a week or a moment even. He can manifest all the splendors of all the virtues of all the Buddha fields within a single Buddha field. He can place all living beings in the palm of his right hand, and can show them with a supernatural speed of thought all the Buddha fields without ever leaving his own Buddha field. It's really heavy, no? All living beings in your right hand, and show them all the Buddha fields and all their splendors without getting up from your seat. He can display in a single pore all the offerings ever offered to all the Buddhas of the ten directions, and the orbs of all the suns, moons, and stars of the ten directions. Like Krishna, remember the one we talked yesterday. But in any one pore, you can see the whole galaxy, all of the suns and all of the galaxies, not just another one, but all of the ones that there are there. He can inhale all the hurricanes of the cosmic wind atmospheres of the ten directions into his mouth without harming his own body and without letting the forests and the grasses of the Buddha fields be flattened. He can take all the masses of fire of all the supernovas that ultimately consume all the universes of all the Buddha fields into his stomach, without interfering with their functions, and so on. This is totally inconceivable. Each inconceivable kind of thing, you know, getting out into sort of cosmic dimension, going into micro dimensions. Oh, it's even worse. It gets worse, actually, conceptually. A bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation can magically transform any kind of living being into a universal monarch. You want to be a universal monarch? Control the whole planet? Be a king of the planet? Turn them into that. A Lokapala, a god who protects the world, bigger than the universal monarch. A Chakra, that's an Indra. A Brahma, that's a creator god. A disciple, a solitary sage, a Bodhisattva, and even into a Buddha. You want to be a Buddha? Be a Buddha. But if there was a Bodhisattva like that, they could do. The Bodhisattva can transform miraculously all the cries, noises, superior, mediocre, and inferior of all living beings of the ten directions into the voice of the Buddha, with the words of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, having them proclaim impermanent, miserable, empty, selfless, and he can cause them to recite the words and sounds of all the teachings taught by all the Buddhas of the ten directions. Reverend Shariputra, I have shown you only a small part of the entrance into the domain of the Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation. Reverend Shariputra, to explain to you the teaching of the full entrance into the domain of that of the Bodhisattva who lives in the inconceivable liberation would require more than an aeon and even more than that, so it's impossible. Although, by showing the true nature of reality, the Buddhas do not wash away sins with water. They do not heal by laying on of hands. They do not transmit their own understanding into the mind of another, this famous verse. They show the nature of ultimate reality, that is emptiness, and thereby introduce beings to their own liberations. Okay, that's that famous verse, right? The Buddha is not supposed to do that. But by doing that showing, by teaching that ultimately, they introduce the beings to liberation, the inter beings become enlightened. From the Buddha's perspective, of course, remember that the future moment of the being's achievement of Buddhahood is just as real and just as imminent, in a sense, as the present moment. And that doesn't have to mean a fatalistic determinism, because also each instant of that being's struggle, and the fact that that being can take different options and go and do it in different ways, and there's a kind of, it all is up to them in a way in the process. The Buddha can see all of that and yet still see the causality, still allowing for that in a sense, you know, see the causality of where that being comes to Buddhahood and actually see the person's Buddhahood. In that sense, the Buddha, in showing that liberation, has in a sense made them a Buddha from a certain perspective. By creating a Buddha land, he is making the beings Buddhas, in a way. So that's one way you could take it. And from the person, it is not being made a Buddha because they're struggling and they have to come to it themselves. It's like that paradox that you find in the Madhyamaka, where it is said that the only way to understand selflessness is to hear the teaching of selflessness from another who understands selflessness. Isn't that funny? And it is only that you can understand it, of course. And yet you have to hear from another who has understood it, from another who has understood it, and yet what each self is understanding is selflessness. It's very funny. It's an inconceivability again. It collides in a lovely way. But yet you have to hear selflessness from one who understands selflessness. For you then to understand yourself, your own selflessness. It's quite a lovely kind of thing. You know? So you can say what? You can say either way. You know? You can not say anything. Anyway, you could also take this as that in the turning of them into this, the Bodhisattva, is only really doing to give them a kind of sense of being a Buddha. You could interpret it also. And these are sutras. You could say this means he gives people the sensation of being a Buddha. He gives them the sort of vision of being a Buddha. They are then going to have to achieve being a Buddha themselves to stay permanent. It's like the Buddha puts his toe on the ground and makes this look like such and such a Buddha land. But before those beings can see it that way themselves all the time, they have to become enlightened. They have to become Buddhas. Okay, then the patriarch Mahakashyapa, having heard this teaching, just wait, we have to add one thing to this, inconceivable. Having heard this teaching of the inconceivable liberation of the Bodhisattvas, was amazed. And he said to the Venerable Shariputra, Kashyapa this is, Shariputra, you know, this is fabulous. I don't want to read it because of time, you know. But he said, Shariputra, this is fabulous. It's a wonderful thing. We saints, we arhats who hear this, we should feel sorrowful. We should utter a wail of woe that would shake the universe because we're sort of burnt out in a certain way, like our imaginations, our passions, our sort of imaginative energy in a certain way is already burned away. He thinks so on the conscious. He doesn't realize his instincts are still in good shape, Kashyapa. But he thinks that he's all sort of burned out. He has realized selflessness. He is a saint. So it won't help us really to hear this teaching, but we can admire it. When a bodhisattva hears this teaching, he should be like a young, joyful as a young crowned prince when he takes the diadem and is anointed, and they should increase to the utmost their devotion to this inconceivable liberation. Kashyapa wants to applaud this fantastic teaching. He's had kind of a vision of it, you know. But he also realizes that he's kind of too cooled out, you know. He's like so enlightened on some level without having a certain another kind of energy that can lead him into the imaginative sphere of the Bodhisattva inconceivable liberation, he thinks. So then he says, indeed, what could the entire host of Marans ever do to one who is devoted to this inconceivable liberation? In other words, who could be evil? Where could evil come in? Where could Satan, I mean, Satan couldn't even bother a Bodhisattva in inconceivable liberation type of thing. It's his way of saying it's truly great. Naturally, Vimalakirti has to, as my son would say, rag on him. 32, and of course, even though 32,000 gods conceived the spirit of unexcelled perfect enlightenment when Mahakashyapa said that, 32,000 of the gods said, hey, the patriarch lights it? Wow, let's be Buddhas. And they had conceived the spirit of unexcelled perfect enlightenment. But then Lichavi Vimalakirti said to the patriarch Mahakashyapa, Reverend Mahakashyapa, the Maras, who play the devil, and that's a literal Sanskrit expression, who play the devil, in innumerable universes of the Ten Directions, are all bodhisattvas dwelling in the inconceivable liberation, who are playing the devil in order to develop living beings through their skill in liberative technique. Reverend Mahakashyapa, all the miserable beggars who come to the bodhisattvas of the innumerable universes of the Ten Directions to ask them for a hand, a foot, an ear, a nose, some blood, muscles, bones, marrow, an eye, a torso, a head, a limb, a member, a throne, a kingdom, a country, a wife, a son, a daughter, a slave girl, a horse, an elephant, a chariot, a cart, gold, silver, jewels, pearls, conscience, crystal, coral, beryl, treasures, food, drink, elixirs, and clothes. These demanding beggars are usually bodhisattvas living in inconceivable liberation who, through their skill and liberative technique, wish to test and thus demonstrate the firmness of the high resolve of the other bodhisattvas. If you ever read the Jatakas, there are these horrible, creepy characters who come and they say, "Oh, Buddha, I need a new head today. Could I have your head, please?" You know, type of thing. And, "Oh, great." Buddha goes, they're always doing that. You know. And, but first, Buddha gives a long speech about how happy he is to give his head. You know. The worst one of the Visantara is considered the worst of those Jatakas, where he gives his children and wife. Very tragic. It's the sort of Buddhist Christmas carol, that one is, where because it ends happily, but that's a sort of Scrooge character who comes and demands the children. Horrible guy named Jujaka, awful man, comes and drags them away by the hair. Buddha's two beautiful children, Vasantara, two little prince and princess, drags them away. They're going, "Daddy, Daddy, it's not really an old man. It's a demon who's going to have us for dinner and cook us as a cannibal. Don't give us to this man." "Sorry, I swore I would give anything to everybody." Right? Oh, it's sort of the endless controversies. It's the Buddhist Abraham and Isaac story. He doesn't get them back. He gives them away. He swore. He told his wife, said, "Don't come with me." He's banished from his country because he gives away the MX system. He gives away the aircraft carrier. He gives away the magic, which is a magic elephant that can reproduce itself endlessly and win any battle. It just goes out on the battlefield and stamps its foot and trumpets once and the whole enemy falls down. You know, it's a great elephant. And he gives that away to the national enemy, to the Russians. And so they banish him. And then he tells his wife, "Don't come, don't bring the children. I have to give everything away. If somebody asks me for you, I'll give anything." You know. And so then she says, no, I don't care. But then, of course, she does care. When he does, then everybody freaks out. But then it all works out later in the end, fine. They just was put to the test that way. The other horrible one is the one of Shibi, the king of Shibi, who gives away his eyes. First eye transplant operation in history. He has surgeons come and they remove his eyes. And he insists on no anesthetic because he wants to make sure they don't pretend to botch the operation or say it was impossible, we couldn't do it, or the patient died. You know, like killed the guy who asked, the old beggar, the blind man who asked and for the transplant. And, you know, because to save their king, he was the king of the country. And they don't want him to give away his eyes. He has exceptionally beautiful eyes. You know, they're the eyes that everybody in the country has. They have icons of his eyes all over this guy. King of Shibi, his name is. And he stays awake, and as they're pulling out the eye, he's going, "Oh, wonderful, now I've really done something difficult. I'm giving something, I'm so pleased." And they pull out the other one. "That's careful," he's saying, "careful, don't." He needs that, he's going to use that eye. Then he gives the eyes to the other beggar. Then they don't do the beggar any good. The transplant doesn't take. And so it's just a waste type of thing. And they say, "Now, Your Majesty, don't you see what an asinine thing? Now the king of the country has become a blind man. Stupid beggar didn't help. How can you, you know, aren't you foolish? Now, don't you agree that you are foolish?" All the ministers and everybody who argue with him. And he says, "Guys, there's a different kind of calculus somewhere, you know. I'm not foolish, nor do I regret that I made the gift. If I truly do not regret that I ever made the gift, may my eyes be restored totally as they were before." And instantly they're back. If I truly do not regret it, if I'm truly delighted by it. And boom, he has his eyes back. It's very far out. Shibi story. Anyway, why did I say that? Oh yeah, he says that the bodhisattva, the people who come and ask those bodhisattvas for these horrible things, are bodhisattvas in inconceivable liberation. Lucifer is a bodhisattva in inconceivable liberation, that means. Satan is a bodhisattva in inconceivable liberation. Mara is the original Satan. You know, they had no Satan in West Asia until they borrowed from India. I don't know if you know that. But the Dutch have proved it. The Dutch folklorists and scholars. Huh? Well, they traced a theme through literature. There was
where did they come west?
with Buddhism, when Buddhism came west. In the early centuries, Shoka sent Buddhist missionaries to Palestine, to Egypt, to Greece. It came west in those times, from those times on. There was a tremendous trade from India to Alexandria. This Western notion that everything just sprung up there in the Mediterranean is, of course, chauvinistic nonsense. Anyway, Satan is a good guy. But what does that mean? That means that good and evil is the point. Mahakashyapa, who has a dualistic worldview of this is samsara, I want to get to nirvana. We have to keep away Mara. He's the one who tempts the monk away from his virtue. There's good and there's evil. And there's a certain timeline of getting away from good. And there's sort of a battle and a struggle of life is like this and so on. This is an illusion, he's saying. It's like the ordinary and extraordinary. Good and evil are part of the ordinary. In the extraordinary, there is only good. The power of good is uncontested. There is evil, but evil cannot withstand good. Good is all overwhelming, that means. Let's see. It's a symbol of that. And his proof of it is that just as a glowworm cannot eclipse the light of the sun, so, Reverend Mahakashyapa, it is not possible without special allowance that an ordinary person can thus attack and deprive a bodhisattva. Just as a donkey could not muster an attack on a wild elephant, even so, Mahakashyapa, one who is himself, not himself a bodhisattva, cannot harass a bodhisattva. Only one who is himself a bodhisattva can harass another bodhisattva. And only a bodhisattva can tolerate the harassment of another bodhisattva. Reverend Mahakashyapa, such is the introduction to the power of knowledge of liberative technique of the bodhisattvas who live in the inconceivable liberation. So this is the ordinary and extraordinary. Which I like it. Now, Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, we go now to the goddess chapter. How, good sir, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? Vimalakirti replies, it's kind of funny, this is one of the humorous passages of this, replies with a lot of metaphors for things that do not exist. Like the reflection of the moon in water. Or as the magicians regard men created by magic. Like a face in a mirror, the water of a mirage, you know, unreal things. Like the erection of a eunuch. There's some funny ones. Like a tortoise hair fur coat. A tortoise hair fur coat. Many things like that. Like the reincarnation of one who has attained ultimate liberation. All sorts of impossibilities. He says, that's how you should look at a living being, as an impossibility. Then he says, that's precisely thus, Manjushri, does a bodhisattva who realizes ultimate selflessness consider all beings. He's referring here now to the great compassion, which is the non-perceiving great compassion. The great compassion which does not see an object of its compassion. Which sees living beings as if they were not there in this sense. You see, as if they were unreal. Therefore, really sees those living beings' Buddhahoods. Sees all the Buddhas in the atoms of those living beings. Therefore, is not taken in by those living beings' self-convincement that they are miserable, suffering men, the samsara, and there's good and evil, and all things are awful, and it's a terrible day, and many things. But yet sees them that they see it that way themselves, but yet does not ultimately see it that way. This is why that compassion is then effective, because the being who has it sees the other beings as all right, as perfect. But then Manjushri says, but wait, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way as if they were so unreal, then how does he generate the great love toward them? Which is the question one wonders. You want to say, well, they must be real. I must have a passionate sense of their reality to really love them. Otherwise, it's very horrible and cold and unfeeling and dreadful. We get this question all the time. He says, when a bodhisattva considers all living beings in this way, he thinks, just as I have realized the Dharma, so should I teach it to living beings. Thereby, he generates the love that is truly a refuge for all living beings. The love that is peaceful because free of grasping. The love that is not feverish because free of passions. The love that accords with reality because it is equanimous in all three times. The love that is without conflict because free of the violence of the passions. The love that is non-dual because it is involved neither with the external nor with the internal. The love that is imperturbable because totally ultimate. Thereby he generates the love that is firm, its high resolve unbreakable like a diamond. The love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature. The love that is even, its aspirations being equal. The saint's love that has eliminated its enemy. The bodhisattva's love that continuously develops living beings. The Tathagata's love that understands reality. The Buddha's love that causes living beings to awaken from their sleep. The love that is spontaneous because it is fully enlightened spontaneously. The love that is enlightenment because it is unity of experience. All things are equally unique, equally ecstatic and exquisite. It is a unity, what is called unity of experience means ekarasatwa, unity of taste. Everything has the same taste. The love that is has no presumption because it has eliminated attachment and aversion. The love that is great compassion because it infuses the Mahayana with radiance. The love that is never exhausted because it acknowledges voidness and selflessness. The love that is giving because it bestows the gift of dharma free of the tight fist of a bad teacher. The love that is morality because it improves immoral living beings. The love that is tolerance because it protects both self and others. The love that is effort because it takes responsibility for all living beings. The love that is contemplation, dhyana, because it refrains from indulgence in tastes. The love that is wisdom because it causes attainment at the proper time. The love that is liberative technique because it shows the way everywhere. The love that is without formality because it is pure in motivation. The love that is without deviation because it acts from decisive motivation. The love that is high resolve because it is without passions. The love that is without deceit because it is not artificial. The love that is happiness because it introduces living beings to the happiness of the Buddha. Such Manjushri is the great love of the Bodhisattva. That's a really particularly good one, I think. I like that. What is the great compassion of a Bodhisattva? It is the giving. Then they do a dialogue. What is the great compassion of a Bodhisattva, says Manjushri? Vimalakirti says, it is the giving of all accumulated roots of virtue to all living beings. What is the great joy of the Bodhisattva? It is to be joyful and without regret in giving. What is the equanimity of the Bodhisattva? It is what benefits both self and others. To what, then there's a wonderful series of dialogue here. Manjushri says, to what should one resort when terrified by fear of life? Manjushri, a bodhisattva who is terrified by fear of life, should resort to the magnanimity of the Buddha. Where should he who wishes to resort to the magnanimity of the Buddha take his stand? Again, that's a faith thing, right? Devotional, magnanimity of the Buddha. It seems to be, at least. Where should he take his stand? He should stand in equanimity towards all living beings. To stand in the magnanimity of the Buddha, you should stand in an equal-mindedness towards all living beings. That is, loving all of them equally. That means not your friend and not your enemy and so on. I mean, not loving your friend and not loving your enemy. Where should he who wishes to stand in equanimity toward all living beings take his stand? He should live for the liberation of all living beings. What should he who wishes to liberate all living beings do? He should liberate them from their passions. How should he who wishes to eliminate passions apply himself? He should apply himself appropriately. How should he apply himself to, Manjushri doesn't stand for that, how should he apply himself to, quote, apply himself appropriately? He should apply himself to productionlessness and to destructionlessness. That means they mean emptiness in a way, but yet emptiness in the sense that all things are unproduced, that this is all uncreated, unproduced in a certain way. What is not produced and what is not destroyed? And you think now you're going to get a sort of absolute, well, nothing is produced, nothing is destroyed, right? No. Evil is not produced and good is not destroyed. That's a great one. Why? What is evil? Evil is an illusion. Evil is selfishness, basically. The root of it is selfishness. Therefore, there is no self to which the ishness can attach. One can try to push it into that presumed that we've been taught by our cultures and things and habits and our instincts that into that vacuum, but there is no such thing. So it is futile. Therefore, it is never produced because how you want to be selfish, you want to grab it, there's nothing, no place to put it because there is no self. And because there is no self, there is nothing that is not selfless. Therefore, good cannot be destroyed. Since good is pure, is selflessness, good is self-emptying, good is self-expanding, good is openness, it cannot be destroyed. Because there is no opposite of it in this sense. What is the root of good and evil? He says, materiality is the root of good and evil. That's an interesting one. Materiality almost sounds Gnostic, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It means, thank you. Materiality is the root of good and evil. Meaning, satkaya. Satkaya means the seeing, but materiality here means the seeing of things as if they were real in themselves. Materiality means the sense of there being a materiality of this book, that it has some intrinsic objectivity. It's the same thing, really, as that concept of intrinsic objectivity we were talking about the bricks yesterday. That things are not constructed by relationships, but the way in which this thing appears as if it existed over there in its own right. That I don't feel I have anything, or our conventions or our collectivity has anything in the constructing of this thing that we're responsible for, the feeling that it is self-existent in its own right. That is what materiality means. And of course, that's the root of good and evil, because that's where the self appears to be absolute. Others appear to be absolute. The self wants to grasp others. The self wants to destroy others, which are all the desire, hatred, pride, envy, and so forth. These are the things. But then he said, okay, what is the root of materiality? What is the root of that materiality? And he's not, I want to emphasize, however, the negative habit pattern here, though. This passage is not just stressing the negative side, because he says, what is the root of materiality? He says, well, desire is the root of materiality. We want things to be like that. What is the root of desire and attachment? And then why do we have desire and attachment? Unreal construction is the root of desire and attachment. Something unreal, a construction of an unreality, is the root of desire and attachment. What is the root of unreal construction? The false concept is its root. The false concept of this real self that we want to grab all these things for. What is the root of the false concept? Baselessness is the root of the false concept. That is, where is the root of this thing? It has no root. It is baseless. It's baselessness is the root of the false concept. There is no such self-constituted, absolute, relative thing. There is only relative things. Therefore, the false concept is baseless. That is why it is false. Manjushri then presses to the limit here. He says, what is the root of baselessness? And Vimalakirti then becomes impatient. He says, Manjushri, when something is baseless, how can it have any root? Therefore, all things stand on the root which is baseless. Therefore, actually, even ignorance stands on shunyata, then. An emptiness. Therefore, in a way, there is no ignorance. There is no evil. Evil is not produced, and good is not destroyed. Everything is full of interconnectedness. And that interconnectedness is shaped by love and compassion and joy and equanimity. Being truly selfless is based on baselessness itself. It's based on emptiness. True love, since love is the wish for others to be happy, right? It is, in that sense, a process of self-emptying. Therefore, it automatically issues from the realization that there is no self to sort of pull back into. And therefore, when one becomes aware of selflessness, not just saying, I should be selfless, but actually aware that there is no self in which not to be selfless, then that is the source of love. And in that sense, love emerges from the absolute. If we see the absolute as selflessness, if we see the absolute as emptiness, love emerges from that emptiness. In fact, love is that emptiness. The famous expression of Nagarjuna is that emptiness is the womb of great compassion. Shunyata karuna garbham. Very beautiful Sanskrit phrase. Shunyata karuna garbham. Which can be analyzed in various ways, but the way I like is that emptiness is the womb of compassion. Although in another way, that's an impossibility, of course, or rather it serves as the womb of compassion by being empty of itself, emptiness, in a sense by not existing, in a sense, therefore, in another sense, then no, according to your question, in the sense that love is everything in that sense, in that vision. Why, in other words, why has the Buddha become Buddha? Why can the land become a Buddha land? Why has the Buddha's vision of relative reality, the extraordinary relative reality, more real, relatively speaking, than the ordinary relative reality of hells and suffering and so forth? Why? Although only relatively more real, right? Since only emptiness is ultimately real, and in a way emptiness is empty and does not exist. But why is that extraordinary one more real? Because it is... why is it more real anyway? Why is it more real? Because it is true. Because everything is love. Because the Buddha's vision is based on truth. And the other one is based on error. That is why. And truth does prevail over error. Type of thing. But somehow, I don't know why. don't know why I lost the train there. But that is why. You know, for example, the Dalai Lama explained that, I think I was, because I was coming, my mind was a passage in a talk at Amherst where the Dalai Lama was saying that positive states of mind, such as wisdom, based on truth, inevitably prevail over negative states of mind based on error. Because erroneous states of mind constantly are disconfirmed in experience. Because there is an error there, and it's like another lie to support it, and lies mean a constant effort against the grain of what is there. Whereas truth, everything reconfirms truth. And as soon as the effort of making the lie against it disappears, then the truth emerges. So that everything tends to confirm true states of mind, such as the wisdom of selflessness. And that means that there is that love is the ground radiation of the universe. Because relationship is the ground, and relationship that is aware of relatedness, and is hence aware that no node in the nexus of relationship is more important than other nodes, and that all are in a sense indivisible, interconnected, which is what love is in a certain sense, say spoken of in a physical sense, is therefore more powerful than a tendency to separation, an attempt to retreat from relationship. Since you can't, there is no retreating from relationship. There's no relative way to get out of relativity, in other words. Luckily, Vimalakirti luckily remains silent, so one can always, whenever one loses one's wits and one's thread, one can resort to that.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US Menla membership community and listeners like you, and is distributed through a Creative Commons No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, like, and post on your favorite social media platform. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.